Dot com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection. Napster is used by millions and millions of people because it's brain-dead simple. You download the software, fill in a search line, and voila! All the Mariah Carey songs you never wanted to hear appear in a window. Click on the one you want, and the download begins. At least until the courts shut it down. The high-tech wizards call this peer-to-peer networking because your computer connects directly to another person's to download the music. The normal way we make connections on the internet is to point our browser at an internet address and get connected to a server. The jargon for this is client-server. You're the client, the customer, and the computer on the other end serves up your order. But in peer-to-peer computing, everybody's computer becomes a server, and all of that complicated internet addressing just disappears. The world of possibilities for these kinds of connections is endless, and that's why a lot of people think this is really the next big thing. And it's not just about music. All kinds of files can be shared, and the millions of computers connected to the internet could be joined together to create a supercomputer for people who can't afford to own one. Connection listeners, how will people computing change the way you use the internet, and at what point does friendly sharing become conspiracy to commit grand-scale larceny? 1-800-423-8255 is the P2P connection, 1-800-423-TALK, or join us online at theconnection.org. Joining me in the studio is Andy Oram. He's the editor of a new book just out this week called Peer-to-Peer, Harnessing the Power of Disruptive Technologies. I love that word, disruptive technologies. And from the studios of the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City, Clay Shirky. He's a partner for technology at the Accelerator Group, and he's written a lot of articles recently about peer-to-peer computing, P2P computing, people computing is what I call it. I want to say right now that we're not doing a show on Napster. It's peer-to-peer. It's a peer-to-peer star that's been around grabbing a lot of headlines, but there's a new kid on the block. Several new kids on the block, and we want to talk about them and the future of P2P computing. Andy, I think that it's a good place to start to just give a little bit further description of how this stuff works as different from how we experience the internet right now.
Since programmers tend to think in their own way, the name Nutella is a kind of strange one, so let me start by explaining that. I guess someone liked that chocolate spread Nutella. So they took the name, which is, of course, a trademark violation, and they put a G on the front, making the first syllable GNU, which was the name of some other important software that free software people care about. But Nutella is sort of out there in the press is the next file-sharing technology. That's kind of a shame because, really, file-sharing is pretty inefficient through Nutella. That's not the way it could best be used. It's worth looking at peer-to-peer as something much broader because something like searching would be a much better use of Nutella, and that's what's being explored by the people who are scattered around the world right now working on Nutella.
So you could actually use this new application as a different kind of search engine than the kind of search engines we're used to?
Exactly. I'll explain it very briefly. You download the Nutella client. Then you find a couple friends, or you go to some site, which is centralized, so it's not exactly peer-to-peer, but you find a few friends who are running Nutella, and you connect to them. You type in a search, something you want. It goes to the friends, and they send you back data, and I'll explain how they do that in a minute, and then they send the search on to their friends, and it goes out over the net, and stuff comes back. The reason this is great is that each program, each computer can do the search the way it wants. If someone has a database, their own personal database, or a company has a database full of stuff, they can search that database and return the stuff to you. And you couldn't do that on a traditional search engine.
One of the people in your book described this as, say you're going to a party, and you walk in the front door, and you meet the host, and then the host introduces you to the next few people, and those people, and you say you want to find a sushi bar, and you send out that word through all of the people at the party. If you were in the old technology, you would come in, you would see that you would visit the host, say you want to find a sushi bar, and you'd be in the grips of the host for the rest of the evening because the word wouldn't spread out through the party. Clay Shirky, down there at the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. Clay, do you think Nutella is going to replace Napster as the next file sharing application?
I think anything is going to replace Napster, just sort of drop in some new thing where Napster was. If you if Napster goes away as thoroughly as it seems like it may this week, I think people are going to spread to all sorts of systems. There's certainly Nutella, but there's also Aimster. Freenet is not quite ready for prime time, but they're working on it. There are systems like Audio Galaxy, which are much closer to being Napster clones. The interesting thing is going to be to see where, how many other systems people adopt at the same time, because there are a lot of things that, that not only have Napster functionality, but are trying to extend it to new uses outside of music file sharing.
Are these things as easy to use as Napster was? I mean, Napster was very simple to use.
That is the huge revolution of Napster. Obviously, the application that Napster brought to the people was music. But what really went on in the background is that Napster means that people don't have to be second-class citizens on the Internet anymore. Individual users are no longer second-class citizens. Up until Napster, it was really impossible to get an address that you would use to serve files from your PC back out onto the Internet. You were locked into being solely a consumer. And Napster has made it, as you said in the intro, dead easy to be a provider of information. One of the misfortunes about a lot of the technological work that's going on in peer-to-peer right now is it's going on the engine, but not the dashboard. And the thing about Napster is it made it so easy to use. So there are a handful of applications that really have achieved Napster's sort of ease of use. Audio Galaxy certainly is one of those systems. Aimster, which are using sort of familiar interface icons. But Napster was really the high watermark for that so far, and nobody's quite figured out how to replicate that yet.
I downloaded one of the Nutella applications called Toad Node last night and used it for a while. And it seemed to be very simple. It didn't provide me with as much information about the music as Napster did, but it seemed to be very simple. People are working out there hard on these things. 1-800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Join us on The Connection. We're talking about peer-to-peer computing. It sounds like something in the British House of Lords, but in fact, it has to do with people's computers talking to other people's computers. One of the things about Nutella that's often pointed out in the press that's different from Napster is that Napster used a centralized server index so that there was a place you could actually find everything that went on in Napster. That's not true of Nutella, is it, Clay?
No, that's not. Nutella actually made full decentralization part of their goal. One of the interesting debates going on in the peer-to-peer community right now is how much decentralization is enough. And there are certain systems where anything less than total decentralization is failure. Probably the ideological high water mark is Freenet, which assumes that every node is in the hands of the enemy at all times. And they're still trying to build a network out of that. But one of the lessons I think we can take from Napster is that it was the fastest growing software application of all time. It got 60 million users in an incredibly short period of time, partly because it had such a savvy mix of centralization and decentralization. The primary advantage of decentralized systems right now is legal. You can, as you say, fail to provide an address where you would serve a subpoena. But it's not clear, as the music industry and other copyright industries grapple with the world of digital intellectual property, that evading the law is going to be any kind of long-term, isn't going to provide these systems any kind of long-term value. I think we're going to see systems where decentralization is a tool but not a goal.
And Clay, you probably know that Nutella and Freenet, although they started out as these very purist decentralized systems, each one is introducing some kind of hierarchy, some new point where you can focus on things. They're getting a little more realistic. In Freenet, they find that it's hard for people to do searches, so some websites are putting up URLs that go to Freenet, so people are really going to the website just like any other website. And Nutella is introducing what they call super peers. So these are places where everybody knows they're there and they can serve up the content more quickly than if you try to do the pure decentralized thing.
1-800-423-8255, 800-423-423-TALK. Paul is on the line. Paul, welcome to The Connection. We thought Paul was...
Hello.
There. Hello, Paul.
Well, my question had to do with the idea that, one of the ideas that was floating around, that what people really wanted and object, one of the things that people objected to with music was having to spend, you know, $15 or $18 to plunk out for a CD that had one song on it that they liked. And the idea was that people would be happy and willing to pay 50 cents or a dollar in order to just get one song and download it over the Internet. And I'm wondering, you know, what happened to that idea, and why hasn't the record industry sort of leapt on that idea as an opportunity rather than fighting any form of that?
Clay Shirky, you wrote an essay that I read that was titled something like What the Music Industry Can Learn from Napster. And I don't want to dwell too long on the issue of the music industry, but you might go over what you thought they could learn.
Well, there is, in fact, a sort of a larger issue here, which is whether or not music is a product or a service. I think one of the reasons that idea that you would download individual songs and pay for them has not caught on is that in a digital world, it doesn't really make sense to treat things as objects. We've seen this consistently in news feeds, in software, what have you. Things that were sold in physical packages offline typically become services when they move online. Like one of the interesting splits you can see going on right now is that the music industry as a whole is not upset about Napster. The recording industry is upset about Napster. The people who have a stake in music being tied to physical objects called CDs. ASCAP, the American Society for Composers and Performers, has perfectly well worked out ways to pay artists when their music is played on the radio, for example. And radio is a service and not a product. So it's not so much a question of whether individual songs are pulled off of a CD and sold for 50 cents or a dollar as can you continue to have per unit pricing for music online? And the answer when we look at other industries that have faced this sort of intellectual property in a digital age problem is no, that what music really is going to become is a service with service-based or subscription-based pricing. So the idea of unit pricing is itself what's being challenged here. The reason the recording industry is upset about this more than the music industry as a whole is the recording industry derives all of their money from selling physical objects, from selling CDs and tapes and in the old days albums.
So let me just jump in here for a second, because music is not the only kind of file that can be shared using these technologies. You could do books, you can do video, and once we get enough bandwidth, you can do video. You can do all kinds of things. Are you suggesting that
you could do O'Reilly books?
Even the book industry would become a service rather than a unit sales business?
Yes, that seems to be what is happening. And as Andy mentioned, O'Reilly is experimenting with a system called Safari, where you turn in a monthly subscription and you then can have some number of O'Reilly books accessible and searchable electronically. Digital data isn't really objects. This has been hidden from us for 20 years by the GUI interface pioneered by Macintosh, these little pictures of files on our desks. But it's really all just streams of ones and zeros, and it can all be treated as a service. It can all be treated as passing digital data back and forth. There is no objecthood in cyberspace except what we kind of agree we're going to pretend are objects in order to have these sort of convenient handles for files and so forth. But there's no real way to support the current pricing models that we have for physical objects in a digital world without also bringing all of the inconvenience of the physical world onto the internet.
You're listening to The Connection, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about some of the legal issues. We're talking to Andy Oram, who's the editor of a new book, and Clay Shirky, who writes about peer-to-peer technology. And I'm John McChesney, and you can call us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be joined by a lawyer in the next segment. We're going to talk about things legal with these things.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection at 11 o'clock, all about obituaries. What makes a good one? What would you...
I'd like to share it, because if I share it with you, you'll have some too. Well, if I have...
I don't know where you guys dug that up. We're talking about peer-to-peer computing, or the kinds of computing where you connect directly to someone else's computer and share their files. And joining us right now online is Jonathan Zittrain, co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. And obviously, Jonathan, welcome to the show. Obviously, one of the key questions here is whether or not the new decentralized kinds of peer-to-peer computing will obviate, make moot, the legal question. Will they be able to be sued the same way Napster was sued successfully?
Yes. Hi, John. I think it's a lot harder to go after a peer-to-peer system of file sharing from a legal standpoint than it has been so far for the recording industry to go after Napster, because as Clay and Andy have explained, it's a lot more decentralized. That said, I'm not so sure it's all that revolutionary over the long haul. People may momentarily flock to something other than Napster that is peer-to-peer, but there are plenty of other ways, the law being only just one tool in the toolbox, to prevent people from using peer-to-peer networking for activities that are deemed illegal or, you know, otherwise undesirable.
One of the things that happened in the Napster case is that you never saw the recording industry go after their customers. They could have sued a number of users and said, hey, you guys are doing something illegal. That never happened. And I presume it didn't happen because it's not the smartest thing you can do when you're in business to sue your customers. So they went after the Napster. How did they get Napster?
Well, they got Napster on a theory of so-called contributory copyright infringement. It meant that maybe Napster wasn't directly infringing itself, mm-hmm. but it was helping. And just like you might sue a gun company under the theory of, guns don't kill people, but they really help, you might be able to go after Napster for contributory infringement. And whether you think that's a good idea or not, so far it looks as if the Ninth Circuit out in California has pretty much bought that argument, and that's something you could then use to tell Napster they have to shut down. And importantly, once you tell Napster it has to shut down or modify the kinds of files that it allows people to access, then that's it. You can't get the copyrighted music so well anymore through Napster.
Clay Shirky, going down to you for a minute. It seems to me that in Nutella, these decentralized systems, the recording industry or a book company or anybody else who's upset about the sharing of files that are under copyright would have to go after the customer. Does that seem right?
Right, and at some point this gets into the question that Jonathan just raised, and I have to say I am not a lawyer, but this question of undesirability, and Jonathan mentioned things being deemed undesirable, the question becomes sort of undesirable by who? The customers clearly like this. Napster would not have gotten 60 million users in 2 years if it hadn't. So I think a lot of the question is when or under what conditions does the music industry figure out a way to work with this system instead of against it? Suing your customers over the long haul is simply not going to be a successful way to market your product.
Clay, maybe I can take a crack at your question. The middle path I think the music industry might seek is realize there's a lot of cross-ownership between the content providers and the high-speed internet providers, the Time Warner cable people that mm-hmm. bring you, if you're a resident under their footprint, high-speed internet access, and often without much choice if you don't want to use them. They can program the network so that, as is the case with many cable modems, the upload speed, the speed with which you can hurl data out of your computer, is a lot slower than the speed at which you are allowed to download, you know, take stuff off the web and put it onto your computer. Through tweaks like that that have a patina of neutrality to them, you can put a nail into the coffin of a peer-to-peer networking scheme that's attempting to be subversive because people can no longer share stuff so readily, at least not big stuff. They can share small stuff. It's just not the big stuff. So an email virus is a classic peer-to-peer sort of thing. If it's only a couple kilobytes, great, you know, let 1,000 email viruses bloom. But if you're talking about music or even, you know, a program like this, we know, right, Christopher Lydon's out there. He's got ChristopherLydon.org. Suppose he, without a radio station, wants to use peer-to-peer to kind of get his own complimentary show out. I don't know how he's going to do it. I don't see how peer-to-peer particularly helps somebody with content that is bigger than just the email virus or something else when you've got this cross-ownership going on.
I hear a big intake of breath down there in New York.
Right.
Jump in.
The idea that there's going to be some kind of easy technological solution to this has been something that the RIA has been suggesting for some time. I don't think it's true because of the market economy. If cable providers do indeed start limiting upstream bandwidth. And Cox Communications tried this a while ago when they said, oh, you can't run Napster because Napster is a server. People rebel.
But they already do, right?
As long as there is a natural break in upstream bandwidth in cable, there's a natural asymmetry. They can't provide as much upstream as downstream. But as we learned from the invention of MP3s in the first place, as long as the compression algorithms keep getting better and better, file size is never going to be an adequate bottleneck. There are PowerPoint presentations that are larger than MP3 files. And if what you're telling me is I can't download or upload a PowerPoint file from home, simply because you're afraid I'm also going to be trading copyright materials, I'll change ISPs. There's no bottleneck which says illegal media files are of a certain size, whereas legal media files are of a certain other size.
But
the consumer tolerance for limits in upstream bandwidth is quite limited.
Well, but out in California, I know that the AT&T cable guys put a 128 kilobit cap on the uploads, and that's a pretty slow upload thing. So if you want to upload a big video file or something, you're really going to take forever doing that.
I don't think the technology is the main thing that people are concerned with here, and I have a strong statement to make about sharing and about the delivery of content. You can talk to me because I am a content provider. I do copyrighted books. This is my issue, whether I'm going to get remunerated in the new economy. And I'm dealing with it. My company is dealing with it. As Clay said, we have an online site for subscriptions, and we have websites that are funded by advertising, which has killed a lot of internet companies. But whatever works, we'll use. Whatever doesn't work, we'll try something else. And this is my job as a professional to find a way to use new technology and to adapt to social changes, because these are social changes as much as technological changes. Now, I want to say some advice to all the thousands of people who are lined up to make calls saying, how do we pay the musicians? How do we pay the artists? Don't worry about it. They're professionals. They got to deal with it. If you want to worry about something, worry about how to deliver universal health coverage. That's what Bill Gates is working on. He's got his priorities straight.
This does not sound like the voice of the recording industry there. 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. John is on the line. He has a question that I actually am curious about myself. John, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, Jonathan. This is Jonathan Chinitz from Acton, Mass. I actually know Andy from a previous life.
Hi.
A connection.
My question relates to the whole issue of security.
Yes.
A big concern of mine has always been, how do I know what programs I'm downloading, whether I'm inadvertently downloading a malicious program, and now I open myself up not only to destruction of my own equipment, but inadvertently destroying other people's equipment by prolonging and promulgating other viruses. I mean, peer-to-peer to me sounds like with no security, it's not going to get very far.
Well, I've wondered about this myself. I mean, you're opening up your own personal computer to millions of people on the Internet. I never did hear, by the way, a horror story associated with Napster that, somebody had been hacked. But I'm curious, Clay Shirky, you must have looked into this issue. What about security?
Well, I want to go back to the idea that it's not going to get very far. Peer-to-peer is a way of letting users do things with their PCs by directly weaving those PCs into the fabric of the Internet. Things like ICQ, the Instant Messaging Protocol, and Napster have broken this sort of bottleneck of second-class citizenship. And those two applications have tens of millions of users. So it's already gotten far. I think what we have to say about security is, as long as the benefits provided by peer-to-peer are great enough, people will brave the new programs. There will be security breaches. There will be issues. When those issues are discovered, they will be fixed.
Some bands have taken to loading up Napster and Nutella. You think you're about to get, Owner of a Lonely Heart, but in fact it's
this is Jonathan Zittrain.
It's a small lecture from the artist saying, why don't you pay me for my music instead of stealing it off Napster?
But
not exactly a virus, but...
But here's the genius of that, is that bad content doesn't propagate through Napster. If I download a file like that, the next thing I'm going to do is delete it. No single node can flood the network with bad content. There are going to be more good copies of Owner of a Lonely Heart because people will keep them around. The system, like capitalism or democracy, works because of the self-interest of the individual users.
Yeah.
800, I'm going to jump in here and take another call. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. John is on the line. Nope, sorry, Dave is on the line from Western Massachusetts.
Hey, guys, how's it going?
Pretty good so far.
Just enjoying the blizzard down here. I wanted to make it's not too bad yet. I wanted to make one comment that technologies such as, you know, UUCP and a lot of the core internet software, hardware, if you will, has enabled peer-to-peer for an awfully long time. I think programs like Napster and others have much more democratized or made it much easier, if you will, for regular people to do it. But for a long time, you could do CUCME, for example, or any number of applications directly between computers right over the internet.
That's absolutely...
I'm going to give this one to Andy Oram, who's sitting here in the studio.
The book does have a couple chapters about precedents, about the background. And I've talked to a lot of technologists, whereas I have to deal with the general public on the level of, no, it's not just people committing crimes with computers. I have to deal with technologists from the level of, oh, yes, this has gone on before. This is nothing new. But what's different, I think Clay will expand on this, is the scale of it, that computers are so much more powerful, have so much more disk space, and we have more bandwidth now.
Clay, you've actually talked about the different uses that this can be put to, and we haven't done much of that so far in the show, and I want to come back to that. Right now, I have to say goodbye to Jonathan Zittrain, who's the director of the...
Yes. In fact, just before I run off to class, maybe I can offer one more observation
sure.
to Clay and Andy, and that is I see a future of computing in which the personal computer as a generic device sort of fades away, and we end up with appliance-like computers. Think of the TiVo, which you may have heard of, which can record stuff off your cable feed or something.
It's a big hard drive that will record television.
Exactly. Such things can be built by the manufacturers not to particularly take advantage of the bandwidth for peer-to-peer purposes. And the second pincer movement, just trying to be the skeptic here before I run, the second is that there is some precedence now in the law by which we are pressuring the internet service providers, those who provide the network, to not allow rampant copyright violations to take place. Right now, there's a so-called notice and takedown provision by which if a internet service provider is hosting certain content and they're alerted that it's infringing copyright, they will take down that content in order to keep themselves protected. You could see a similar system brought into effect by the law by which if somebody's computer is found to be spewing out lots of copyrighted material, they can simply be taken down, denied access to the network, so as to protect the internet service provider from liability. I don't think this is necessarily a good thing. It just seems to me it's quite a plausible thing that could take place.
Thank you very much, Professor Zittrain, from
sure,
the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at the Harvard Law School. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you.
I want to go to you for a second, Clay, and set up some of the ways in which peer-to-peer can be used instead of just sharing music files. What are the other things we can use this technology for?
Well, the amazing thing to me about peer-to-peer is exactly what the last caller was talking about democratization. Certainly peers talking to each other we've had for 30 years. It's the founding notion of the internet. But for the last 5 or 6 years, when we've been connecting PCs, those PCs haven't been fully woven into the fabric of the network. People haven't been able to provide content from their computers and so forth. And this is the breakthrough here, where as you noted in the intro, it's as easy as it can be to now serve files from your computer with Napster. So
it's always been the promise of the internet, though, right?
Right.
Many,
exactly.
Many to many, not
many to many. And Tim Berners-Lee has been talking about the two-way web for some time, but because of the client-server nature, and because of the weird addressing scheme, the internet used the domain name system, which is fairly broken as far as PCs are concerned. We had to actually bypass a bunch of stuff to get back to that vision. So any file that people want to share, you know, home photos, recipes, home movies, what have you, can certainly be done from within the consumer space. But I think the big change we're going to see is actually going to be in the enterprise space. It's going to the first really...
This is what we mean when we say the enterprise space. We mean company, inside corporations that use
right.
computing.
Right. There is a notion right now of security which suggests that there's a sandbox and that at the edges of the company there's all of this great security with firewalls and so forth. And of course what users have done is habitually bypass that. They've made email the core file transfer application. If I need to get you a file and we don't work at the same company, I have to email it to you, which is annoying, and email gateways have size limits and I get a version control problem and so forth. With peer-to-peer sharing, if I can genuinely have a file on my computer, which is the file I'm working on, and just mail out things to people and say, here, come get the file off my PC. Whenever you get it, you'll be getting the most up-to-date version. That's a huge bypassing of the traditional corporate IT structure. And in just the way that 20 years ago, workers brought in PCs behind the backs of the mainframe guys, workers are starting to smuggle peer-to-peer applications into businesses under the noses of the IT department.
A tradition at companies, the IT guys, the IT Nazis, those poor guys that are often referred to as the fascists of the corporation.
Can I take off on the email issue? And also what the previous caller said about things being old, that this has been done before. We have real peer-to-peer relationships among people using email and instant messaging. And instant messaging is particularly powerful, but it's very unstructured. You're just typing away. It's a stream of letters. There's no way to say, well, this is, say, an outline that I would like you to edit with me. So some of the new applications, which I'd say fall into the peer-to-peer space, make use of something like instant messaging, but it puts some structure in there. And then people, I think individuals as well as corporations, can really have a new use of old data by putting in a little bit of what we call metadata, which says this data is such and such.
1-800-423-8255. We're going to take one more call before a break now. Phil is calling from the Viant Corporation in Boston. Phil, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, I'm Phil Apley, and I think Clay knows us from having we just sponsored a peer-to-peer conference that he was at. And
keep it short, Phil.
Hi. We've had some interesting experiences with peer-to-peer, and one of the things that I've noticed is that everybody on the commercial side is also trying to jump onto the peer-to-peer bandwagon for commercial applications, and sometimes it's not what they're selling isn't actually peer-to-peer. There's a lot of confusion between distributed computing, which is being called peer-to-peer. There's you know, true peer-to-peer stuff, which is the majority of the kinds of things that you're talking about today. But also, and in one case, we had a...
Phil, we're going to take a little break now. We'll come back to you right after the break. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR in Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney. We're talking about peer-to-peer computing.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Coming up in the second hour of The Connection, the most read section in the newspaper, next to the sports pages.
Career opportunities at Allaire.com.
I'm John McChesney. This is The Connection, 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about the post-Napster world. Peer-to-peer computing or people-to-people computing, hooking your computer directly to your neighbor's computer across the Internet so you can share files. And we had a call from Phil at Viant Corporation in Boston. Phil, you're still on the line. I want you to ask your question. You were making a little speech. What's your question?
Yeah, I was going to tell a story, really, about...
Good. Well, let's have the story and then okay. The question.
We were invited to a presentation of a very slick program for collaboration between brokers and analysts, which was billed as a peer-to-peer application. And we began the talk. They had their VP of engineering there or something, and they put up an architecture diagram. And I said, "Well, I don't see any peer-to-peer there." And he said, "Oh, wait a minute, we'll get to that later." And a little while later, I asked another question obliquely referencing peer-to-peer, and he put me off again. Finally, at the very end, I said, "Well, okay, great, but this isn't peer-to-peer, is it?" And he said, "Well, no, not really. We don't really do that." And it was kind of an embarrassing moment for them. But then I said, "Well, if you look at it, it is kind of a peer-to-peer user experience. So from the point of view of the user, it feels like it's a peer-to-peer application, but it's actually implemented in a completely structured, centralized server application." And I just found that to be pretty...
sleazy.
So everybody's trying to grab onto the new buzzword, P2P. My guest in studio is Andy Oram. He's the editor of a new book out this week called Peer-to-Peer, Harnessing the Power of Disruptive Technologies, and down in New York at the Museum of Television and Radio, Clay Shirky. Andy, what do you think about people trying to grab onto the buzzword and ride the wave?
I really appreciate what Phil was saying. Yes, there's a great confusion because the peer-to-peer, of course, is a buzzword. So when I put together the book, I'm not pushing the book, but when I put together the book, I was asking people what unites your different projects. We had, for instance, distributed computing in there, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. We had file sharing. We had instant messaging. And what these people all found they had in common was the problems they had to solve. And as several callers mentioned, like Jonathan Chinitz with his security issue, there are a lot of problems left to be solved, and these are what they have in common.
Clay Shirky, we've seen a lot of these freeware things come along, open source kinds of things like Linux, and then we get Red Hat trying to make money off of it. We've had other kinds of things where they're free for a while, and then somebody tries to grab on and make money. Napster did the same thing. It was headed toward a business model that might or might not have worked. May still, I suppose, if they could get enough record companies to come on board. Do you expect to see that happen with these other decentralized kinds of peer-to-peer technologies like Nutella? Clay Shirky?
Yes, I'm sorry.
There you are, Clay.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, absolutely. I think that there are already people looking to make money on this. And as Phil noted, a lot of people are just slapping P2P on an old client-server business plan and recirculating it to see if they can get some new interest. The big problem with making money on P2P is that the infrastructure owned by P2P systems is at the edges of the network. It's your PC. And so it's not clear that you can make any money directly by running a peer-to-peer network. Certainly people who want to use this architecture can get at an enormous number of otherwise unused resources, but they're going to have to innovate on top of it. And this is the Red Hat argument for Linux. Linux is free, but what Red Hat is doing is providing packaging and documentation and support and so on. And so I think we're going to see the P2P world having had the initial idea that they could aggregate resources from individual PCs. They're going to have to develop business models that take it further than that and provide something of real value that people are going to pay for. In the business space, it's quite easy to see how you could give people serverless intranets and file management and so forth. The consumer problem is much harder.
800-423-8255. 800-423-TALK. Join us on The Connection. Sam is on the line. Sam, welcome to The Connection.
Hi. So if I can just try to take a quick philosophical broad make statement, if this we're talking about technological roadblocks to protect an industry that's really basically 100 years old or so, the recording industry. It came up with certain technology, with the machines, and this whole industry was built around it. And now this industry is being threatened by new technology. Now, the content, art, existed before the records were there. And, in fact, quality of art, whether the quality of art suffered or not with recording industry, the way it's structured now can be argued. People like Woody Guthrie didn't make much money, should have made a lot more. And people like Shakespeare survived in a time when this thing didn't exist at all. So all I want to suggest is that rather than worrying about how to protect the current structure, maybe the discussion should be about how to allow information to flow. And people will always pay for good art. They will always have good artists survive. And I will suggest that a lot of stuff we're getting now just doesn't need to be protected at all.
I won't ask you to name any of what you don't think should be protected.
I have a horse and cart analogy to this. Imagine 100 years ago that the horse and cart drivers were allowed to decide what could go on the roads, and no one could put a new vehicle on the road until it was approved by horse and cart drivers. We wouldn't have automobiles. But as it was, anyone who wanted to use the road could put whatever vehicle they wanted on it. And considering that the true name for a horse and cart driver is a teamster, it seems like they adapted pretty well.
Clay Shirky, I want to ask you about, you've referred to all those PCs connected to the Internet out there as the dark matter of the Internet. You've talked about, you know, the huge hard drives that everybody has now, the very high processor speeds that everybody has, not everybody, but most people do, and the computing power that's available out there on the Internet is tremendous. You talk about being able to use that in other ways. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I think the people who really showed us that most succinctly were the SETI at Home project, the people scanning the radio frequency looking for signals from extraterrestrial intelligence. And there are a lot of companies that have realized, as I think you mentioned earlier, that although each individual PC may not be that powerful, in aggregate they are far more powerful than the most powerful supercomputer ever made. And so you have companies like Popular Power and Parabon and United Devices going out and saying, well, we're just going to aggregate all of this power at the edges of the network, and we're going to be able to model earthquakes or sequence the genome of a bacteria. We're going to attack these incredible medical problems. And the analogy I often make is that it is a way of taking the searching for a needle in a haystack problem and handing out hay one handful at a time. You could search for a needle in a handful of hay. And so if you have millions of computers sort of adding their computing power together, you really can attack problems that you couldn't get at any other way.
There is also a problem that SETI at Home had to face, which was people changing the algorithm a little bit so they could return results a little faster and then making a mistake, so it was actually incorrect results. So SETI at Home had to worry about security and accountability, which is the same thing that people have had to worry about on file sharing. As I said, the problems are the same, even though the applications are extremely different.
What I don't understand, what would I do as an individual? I've got my PC connected to the Internet. I've got one of these persistent connections, DSL or cable, and my computer's on all the time, and I leave it up. What do I do? Rent my computer out to some company that wants to use my hard drive and my processor overnight? How's that work economically, Clay?
Well, this is the weird thing about the economics of peer-to-peer is that you pay for peak pricing, but you actually own your PC for a long period of time. You are really paying for the little bit of time you're using your PC. You own your PC for about 20,000 hours. If you paid $1,000 for it, it's about a nickel an hour. Now, if you're playing Quake and somebody else wants to use your processor time and they offer you a nickel to get offline, you're going to say, no, this is when I want to use the computer. So the logical thing is not for people to get you to pay in individual increments, but for you to find some network or some service to donate your computing time to up front. Now, all of the popular distributed computing projects have done this one of two ways. They've either had something that people are interested in and think, oh, I'm happy to donate this as a kind of charitable donation for curing cancer or whatever. But the minute you get someone where you hear someone is coming along buying your PC cycles to do something you may not approve of, genetically modified food, for example, maybe you have an ethical problem with that, you're going to be less likely to sell your computing time. So a big problem for these companies is to figure out, how do we create an incentive for people to give us their computers to do whatever the market wants rather than projects that they specifically believe in? And nobody has a really good answer for that yet.
1-800-423-8255. Let's take a call from Carrie. Carrie, I think you may have just had your question answered, but let's try. Carrie, welcome to The Connection.
Hi, I didn't catch all of that, but my question was around, it seems that the future is moving towards providing services. And so I'm wondering what sort of emerging technologies would allow me to derive some financial benefit from making services available from my site. We're not really used to paying for content in this country, and I'm just wondering whether the guests see that model changing anytime in the future.
Andy?
I don't think peer-to-peer will totally take over. Unless you do some kind of real fancy kind of micropayments, as Clay was saying, has problems, probably peer-to-peer isn't a great way to offer a service that you pay for. But who can say? Someone may find a way to do it. Client server is going to last for a long time. It's relatively simple. I don't believe we should do something that's really complicated as long as we have something simple that does the job.
Thanks.
And
for
I should,
oh,
oh,
go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to add something quick to that, that the migration to web services is something that's taking place both in the peer-to-peer world and the client-server world. So I think that we're seeing a lot of digital services arise all over. I don't think that's specific to peer-to-peer.
Carrie, thanks for your call. Let's take another call. Sydney's on the line. Sydney?
Good morning.
Welcome to The Connection.
Thank you. I have a suggestion for a way that would make the record companies happy, the consumers happy, and just about everybody happy. And that
that would be a stroke of genius.
Yeah.
<I'll tell you.
laughs> And that is to go to the radio model, and that is to charge consumers by the number of bytes they transfer in MP3 files or in zip files. This would be the responsibility of the ISP to clock the number of zip files, the total volume of zip files and MP3 files, and a national pricing system would be worked out that would return to the music industry the proportionate revenue from the MP3 files, and to the software industry the proportionate revenue from zip files. Then the music companies would be happy that they'd fight to get their music online so that they'd get revenue from it. And the similarly, the software companies would be delighted. The consumer might not be ecstatic at having to pay extra money for large downloads.
So, Clay,
but I think that's realistic.
Clay Shakey, is that realistic?
It's totally unrealistic.
Running
a
meter?
It will never happen because in every country that's ever had per-byte charges, the minute the ISP market gets competitive, the market quickly goes to flat rate. AOL, or rather CompuServe, used to charge per email, a system exactly like the one you were describing, and users loathed it to the point where when anyone offered an alternative, they switched.
Once you have a flat rate, it's hard to get that genie back in the bottle, I think.
Exactly. The radio pricing makes sense, where you devolve payments to the artist based on usage. That makes perfect sense. But it will never be linked to per-byte charges because the history of the telecommunications industry has been away from rather than towards per-byte charges and really any kind of per-usage charges for 150 years.
So, Andy, back to you in the studio. Mm-hmm. Andy Oram, is this going to change everything? You think it's really the next big thing? I know you're selling a book here, but...
I really think so. And as I said, the old ways will continue for a long time. And also, I don't think full, pure decentralization will be very common. I think we'll find some solutions. A lot of companies will try interesting things and go bankrupt. A lot of academics will produce wonderful theoretical models that don't work. But somewhere, we will find something interesting that works.
You've been listening to The Connection. I'm John McChesney. I want to thank my guests. Thanks to Clay Shirky, an analyst and partner for technology at the Accelerator Group. He joined us from the studios of the Museum of Television and Radio. Thanks also to Andy Oram. He's an editor at O'Reilly & Associates in Sebastopol, California. His new book is called Peer-to-Peer, Harnessing the Power of Disruptive Technologies. We also spoke with Jonathan Zittern. He's the director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. You're listening to The Connection from WBUR Boston and National Public Radio. I'm John McChesney.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and by the Allaire Corporation.